We are delighted that you're joining us tonight. I'm Jacob Daniel, your host, and in the next 1 hour, we'll be discussing one of the trends emerging as a challenge to Christians, particularly here in the West. You may have heard about conversion, but in this show, we'll talk about deconversion and why it is important for believers to know what it is and how we can prepare ourselves to counter it. And if you're a listener who has deconverted, this show will be of interest to you as well, as you will learn how Christians provide a counter to some of the objections raised against their faith. But before we get into our topic for tonight, let me introduce tonight's guests who are joining me here in studio, as well as remotely from Iowa. On my left, we have Dr. John Marriott. John, I've known John for about 5 years, I believe, and he's been a great friend. He's a scholar. He has done a lot of work on this topic. So let me introduce John. Welcome to the studio. Tell us a little bit about your work, your ministry, and also about the book that you have published recently.
Sure, Jacob. Thank you for inviting me to the show. I'm really glad to be here. It's been a long time since I've been on the Apologetics.com radio show. I used to be on as a panelist for a number of years and hosted a few times myself, but it's been a while. So it's great to be back. And since I've been here, I have been working a lot at Biola University. I've been teaching there in an adjunct department, in the philosophy department as an adjunct professor, and also in intercultural studies, where I finished a PhD there about 5 years ago. And right now I'm the director for the global learning centers that we have in Switzerland and in Thailand, and also here in Los Angeles. And in the meantime, I've written a book on my research called A Recipe for Disaster, Ways That the Church Sets Up Believers for a Loss of Faith.
Yes. So, I want you to save the details about the book for some time, because we're going to get into it in detail in a while. But before we move into that, let me also introduce Dr. Michael Chamberlain. We've known each other for about the same time, 5 years, and it's been a privilege, brother, and I'm so glad that you're joining us here on the studio today. Tell us about your work and ministry and how you are connected to what's happening here today.
Well, my name is Mike Chamberlain, and I'm an associate professor at the American Language and Culture Institute at Azusa Pacific University. And my research was really dealing with pre-conversion, not deconversion. So I was working with a lot of my students are Chinese atheists who come to a Christian university without even realizing that it's a Christian university. And they take a course with me called The Christian Worldview, and they study Richard Dawkins alongside William Lane Craig. And we have some real great dialogue on that topic. So that's the area of my research. In terms of my church work, I'm working in a church plant called City Bible Church in downtown Los Angeles, Little Tokyo. Citybible.church if you're interested in helping us church plant. And I'm a homeschool father of 5, hopefully not too weird, kids, and trying to prepare them for, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in a life of Babylon. So that's me.
Great.
Wonderful. Go Bruins, huh?
Welcome to the show, Michael. And to your left, I have my dear friend, Finney Prem Kumar. I'm so glad you're joining us here, brother. And tell us about your ministry, Truth Matters International, and what's going on.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Jacob. It's wonderful to join you and the rest of the team. I head up an organization called Truth Matters International, and it has a twofold mission. First and foremost, it's confronting the academy with the truth of Christ, with the truth of the gospel. And then secondly, it's challenging the church to live out the content of the gospel in creative ways, in redemptive ways, for the sake of the kingdom. So one of the basic thrusts of the ministry, the passion of the ministry, is to really understand the ideological voices of our time and to provide the person in the pew the tools that are needed in order to respond effectively, in order to extend the kingdom of Christ. So that's the basic thrust of the organization.
Sure, yeah. And to your left, we have Jaden. Jaden, this is your first time in the studio.
Yes, it is.
Welcome. Yeah, tell us about yourself and how you're connected with John. I know John is a mentor to you. That's what I've been told. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so I'm from Canada. I know John from way back. We know each other through a Christian camp up in northern Ontario there. So I'm not nearly as learned as most of the other people in this room. I like to study apologetics on my own free time, and I've learned a lot from John over the years and from his book. So excited to be a part of this conversation.
Welcome. And we have one more panelist who is joining us remotely from Iowa, Prashant Daniel. Prashant, are you there?
Hear me?
Yeah, we hear you, Prashant. Prashant and I, we've done the same program from Biola University in apologetics, and I've known him for 7 years. I'm so glad, brother, you've taken time to be awake at this time of the hour. What time is it there?
It is actually 2 a.m. here because I'm in Iowa, which is the central time, so that's 2 hours ahead of you guys.
You're brave, brother. Yeah. So tell us about your ministry as well. I know you're doing a lot of work in Iowa, and how's that going?
You know, just a quick history. I was born into a Christian family, originally Indian, but born and raised in the Middle East. And, for the better part of my early young adult life, I lived a pretty nominal Christian life. But I was only after I moved to India, after rubbing shoulders with a lot of Hindus and Muslims, that it really challenged me to take a closer look at my faith and why I believe what I believe. So that's kind of what got me into the field of apologetics. I have a master's in Christian apologetics from Biola. After that, I went on to do an MTH in systematic theology with the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. I'm not part of any organization or anything like that, so I practice some independent apologetics here, and I'm a writer, I'm a blogger. I'm in the process of developing a systematic theology book for kids, and also in the process of creating an apologetics curriculum that can be used to help leaders in churches and other ministries to train their congregations better in this field. So excellent. Those are some of the things I'm doing. And occasionally, whenever I get the opportunity to teach or practice anywhere as the Lord opens up doors, I try to do that.
Great.
So that's what I'm up to.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Prashant. We appreciate you joining us. So as I mentioned earlier in this show, we're talking about deconversion, and I'm sure most of our audience might have heard about conversion. They might be wondering as to what deconversion is. So let me open this up and ask the experts that we have in the studio tonight, what is deconversion? John?
Well, when we speak about deconversion, it's really the undoing of the act of conversion. When someone becomes a religious adherent, they usually go from one position maybe of non-belief to a position of belief, and they adopt a set of doctrines. They become involved in a community. They become part of a long history or tradition, whether that's becoming a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim. In our case, we're talking about Christian conversion / deconversion. Deconversion, then, is when someone goes about undoing their conversion experience. And when they say, I don't believe this anymore, I don't identify as a Christian anymore, and I don't have a relationship with my Christian community anymore. So they leave the church, and they also identify as an unbeliever. Mm-hmm. And they go from having a community, a tradition, and a set of beliefs, really, to having, in many cases, no community, no established systematic set of beliefs, and an identity that is not marked by anything that has a strong core except for what they don't believe in. And so that's what I would say deconversion would be.
How would you respond to someone who would ask, does it have to be that someone has converted or deconverted to atheism, or could it be any faith?
If you could use the words however you like, really, because what we're talking about is a religious transition. You're migrating from one to another. I guess I would say, in the popular literature, books on Amazon, and even in the scholarly literature, when we talk about people leaving a particular faith and becoming a non-believer or becoming secular in that sense, it's typically called deconversion. Because if I go from being a Christian to a Hindu, I go from one community to another, one set of beliefs to another, one tradition to another, one history to another. But when you abandon that, you are not adopting something else when you go from being a religious believer to a non-believer. And so the deconversion kind of is the emphasis on the negative aspect of that. Not negative in a moral sense, like it's not passing a judgment. It's just it's just kind of the loss of those things.
Yeah. Any parallel with apostasy?
It would be the same thing, right? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about apostasy. We're talking about people who were once adherents and identified as part of a religious community. In our case, we're talking about Christians who now say, "I don't believe it, and I'm not part of it anymore."
Yeah. So it's more of a new term, is it? Deconversion.
It is.
People don't have to actually be intimidated by.
That's correct. Yeah, it would certainly be a term that's gaining in popularity because of the internet. If you type in deconversion on the internet, people who have left the faith and no longer will talk about how they have deconverted.
Yeah, I found about 12 million material or related material available on the topic of deconversion. Mm-hmm. Great.
Oh, just a question, John. When you're talking about deconversion, does it mean the person is now affirming like atheism, or can it be? What's the difference between that and just someone falling away?
There would be maybe a slight difference in the wording. There definitely are people who will just sort of drift away from their faith that they once identified with, and now they just might say, "Well, I don't really know what I think anymore. I don't think I believe that anymore, but I haven't really come up with something else." But when I think of deconversion, I think of primarily those people who are pretty adamant that they clearly once believed this, and now they say, "No, it's not true, and I renounce my affiliation with that group." So that would be sort of the distinction.
Maybe I'm thinking of it in terms of deconversion being intentional and also being seen as progressive by the one who deconverts. Mm. Intentional in the sense that it's not just a chronological change, it's a substantive change, a change in the content of what they believe. And then it's seen as progressive because they feel that they are better now for deconverting, or from moving away from what we might call the Christian faith. They're in a better position than they were in. And would you agree with that,
John? Absolutely. Yeah. One of the main finding of my dissertation research was that all of the folks that I interviewed and all of the hundreds of narratives online that I read all said the same thing, that they were set free, that they were liberated, mm-hmm. that they were happy, that they were more fulfilled after leaving their faith. They definitely see themselves as being epistemologically, so their ability in how they know things, they think, is on more firm ground now, that it's based not in what they would call faith, but in reason. They would say morally they're much better now because they don't have to affirm things like the annihilation of the Canaanites or the binding of Isaac or some penal substitution theory that they would find morally challenging. And they would say that they are less critical and negative of outsiders. And they feel maybe a sense more connection to humanity as a whole now, because there's not an us and them. There's just an us. We're all on this planet together, and no one's any more special because they have some secret religious knowledge. So, yes, there's definitely a progression to I'm in a better place now.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely get into that substantive thing that you mentioned about. In terms of statistics, do you think there's a rise in terms of people claiming, or is it because we have now internet that they're very vocal about, on social media and other places in terms of, or did we always had that kind of people, moving out of Christian faith?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I would want to say tentatively yes, because almost every statistic and every study that's come out since 2000, for sure, and I have about 22 of them that I have listed, points in the direction that people are leaving the Christian faith or are abandoning their church commitment at record numbers and at record rates greater than that they have in the past. Mm-hmm. Are those people outrightly denying the faith? Well, not necessarily, but they are maybe not connected to a church anymore, right? So there are some stats that will show that people are leaving the church. Then there are others that will say, people are leaving their faith entirely, and that the number of non-believers or nuns are growing, and a proportion of those nuns who say, "I don't have any kind of a faith," would identify as atheists or very strong agnostics, people who say, "I don't know and I don't think that you can know." So, for example, the Assemblies of God put out a study a few years ago that said between 50% and 67% of their young people who attended non-Christian public universities have left the faith after 4 years. The Fuller Youth Institute a few years ago put out a study that said that between 40 and 50% of students in youth groups struggle to retain their faith after graduation. Barna put out a study that said 61% of young adults who were involved in church during their teen years are now completely spiritually disengaged. And so these go on and on and on.
Prashant, if I may ask you, why do you think this is something that the church must look into, and how should we actually prepare ourselves? Is this a matter that we should be concerned about?
Well, yeah. Well, the answer to the last question is a definite yes. I mean, definitely we need to be concerned about it. I think there are so many nuances to this. You know, I was reading a couple of days ago about this writer called Rachel Held Evans, who recently passed away, and I'm sure almost all of you are probably familiar with her. And even though I would probably, you know, theologically come to different conclusions than her, I did feel like Rachel brought a lot of interesting questions to the discussion. She was willing to talk about things that I think the church needs to be better prepared at talking about. And so I think so that's one thing. I think as churches and as Christians, we need to be willing to engage with difficult topics and difficult issues that a lot of people in the pews might be grappling with. And I'm not convinced that most churches have a finger on the pulse of their congregation. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is Christians need to be better at probably making an educated discernment between primary and secondary issues. I think in a lot of places, at least in my opinion, I can't tell you how many churches or Christian communities I've seen where they take an issue that's a secondary or a tertiary issue and they elevate it to such a primary or fundamental level of importance, almost as if to make that sound like an essential aspect of the faith. And if somebody does not hold to that secondary issue, then their entire faith is questioned, their entire identity as a Christian mm-hmm. is questioned. And I think the church needs to get better at dealing with those kind of things and making those kinds of distinctions.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, before we go into our break, I would love to actually hear from any of you. And Finney, in your own experience, you know, do you find that deconversion happen at all ages, or is it prominent among certain age?
At least in my experience, I think I've seen that happen, you know, in various ages, age groups. And it's a problem, I think, that John really addresses well in terms of being internal to the Christian community. Hmm. And so we really need to look at what we're doing, as Prashant said, in terms of how we are socializing them and how we are conducting what we would call discipleship within the church and how we structure it and how it saturates the minds and the hearts of the young people especially, because they are the ones who are most impressionable and they are the ones who are most affected by the changes in culture. So, yeah, it does happen at various age groups, but I think more prone to happen among young people.
And mostly in academia, is that the case?
Actually, I think it happens as early as high school. Hmm. And if you look at the stats, I think quite a bit from the mid-teens up to the early or mid-20s. I think that's a very, very significant age group. Mm-hmm.
You talked about the substantive component in terms of that which leads someone to take a decision like that. And we'll get more into detail in our next segment. But to begin with, what are some of those factors that are leading people, basically, to make a decision like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very vast topic, but maybe let me just take a couple of jabs at it. I think there are many things we can talk about, but let me just focus on maybe the apologetic community and how we train young people in apologetics, and also the apologetic trends that saturate the church at large. Two things that I just will mention very briefly. The first one is how we think about reason or rationality. and how we get young people to think about it within the Christian community. Because a lot of our apologetic methods, especially in terms of popular apologetics, it's really tied to various Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment ways of thinking, how we think about reason in very generic terms. And then we frame it within very generic epistemological frameworks, which are just basically frameworks of knowing. And so we set up a standard that the biblical narrative was never meant to come up against. In fact, all of these standards that we set up are very relative to particular systems. They're very systemic in nature. And so when we set up generic standards that really don't work and that really should not be set up, then we set up people for failure. And then secondly, from the concepts of rationality and epistemology, we move to how we define science as that which idealizes and manifests these values and virtues. And that's another vast topic, and maybe we'll get into a little bit more detail later on.
Sure. Let me just read one of your quotes, John. You say that every sort of deconversion story is like a recipe. It's never simplistic. It's never just one reason. It's usually a combination of ingredients, preparation, and environment. And when we get back from our break, we'll talk about those ingredients, preparations, and environment that you talk about in your book. Radio show. We are today talking about deconversion. We've been talking about some of the definitions of deconversion. And I have Mike here, Michael Yes. Chamberlain, who would want to actually contribute a couple of thoughts in terms of what deconversion is.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep it simple because I'm a simple guy. But for the audience, a deconvert, as I understand it, and John, you know, jump in. I'm at Azusa Pacific, and Dan Barker is a graduate from there. And he used to be a worship leader. He has a degree from there, and now he is what, the president or
The Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Freedom from Religion Foundation. So this very strong proponent for atheism in our country is a graduate of a Christian university. But in just simple terms, I had a roommate when I was going to college, and he was involved in investigative Bible studies with me. He was in CREW, which is a parachurch organization. I, you know, you live with a guy, you see him pray every night, and I feel like he was a real believer. I bumped into him a couple of years ago, and he says, you know, a little quiver of his lip, and he says, you know, I don't believe that anymore. I'm a Buddhist. So that's a, but I feel, I know in your writings, you tend to believe that people were, might not be saved, and we can talk about it later, but I feel like he's a prodigal that needs to be called home, but I'm sure we can get into that later.
Sure. I think we can have a show just on that, right? Do you want to respond?
Oh, the only thing that I would want to say to that is that, yeah, a lot of people ask the question, do you think that these people who once identified as Christians and have left the faith, do you think that they were ever truly born again? And what I want to say about that is I'm not really sure. It depends kind of on which day you ask me, whether I've been studying systematic theology or just reading through the text of the New Testament.
Well, it's past midnight, so it's Saturday, right?
True. And I'm not sure what I think about it right now. But what I would say is if you're someone who says, hey, these people were never saved, so therefore anything that you guys are talking about tonight isn't really relevant because a real believer will persevere, what I would want to say to that would be regardless of whether or not some of these folks who have walked away from the faith were saved or not, the problems that we can recognize and identify that bring people to a crisis of faith are ones that really need to be addressed and we need to think through really well, regardless of whether or not they only bring someone to a crisis of faith or they are a catalyst for them losing their faith. If you're someone who thinks you can lose your faith, then you have no problem with what we're talking about tonight because you think that this does happen and people can be saved and then lost. But if you're someone who says, no, you can't lose your salvation, these are still relevant issues because we want to set people up for success, not set them up for a crisis of faith. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we set people up for a crisis of faith, even if it's not possible for them to lose it.
Yeah, what you're saying is that regardless of what position you hold on that, I mean, for parents and for people meeting with, you know, their neighbors or their children, whoever it may be, it's a relevant issue to be dealt with. And
it is.
To be prepared.
Yes, we want to avoid placing as many stumbling blocks as possible in front of the spiritual development of those that we're responsible for.
Yeah. So my question is, I mean, when people choose their worldview, do they do it from an ideologically neutral position, or do they do it also in terms of their reaction to Christianity?
Well, I think that there's a bunch of levels we can answer this on, right? So mm-hmm. there is this, you use the word neutral, and I personally don't think that anyone's neutral. I think that we all have this bent away from believing in the God of the Bible, mm-hmm. and I think that there is evidence that he exists and that we willfully suppress that. But I think that there is a misunderstanding or... I'll just use that word, amongst some people who have lost their faith, thinking that they have done it purely for reason or rational reasons, when often there is a real emotional component and a moral component that may be driving the train of deconversion. And it appears to maybe those on the outside, and even the person themselves, that it is based in reason and rational, logical thinking, when that's not necessarily the catalyst.
So, Finney, would you say that there is a common pattern in terms of people coming to their decision in terms of leaving their faith that you have come across?
Yeah, I think one of the useful things about John's book is that he talks about ingredients. Mm. And so there are a number of reasons why people lose their faith or walk away from the faith. And if you look at it from a purely rational standpoint, when a person says, I think I can no longer believe in Christianity because I don't believe it's rational, the general tendency of the church, or especially those in the apologetic community, is to immediately offer a cumulative case for faith. You know, pile up the reasons mm-hmm. from various fields like archaeology and science and history and so on, and try to convince this person that faith is in fact rational. But I think what we really need to do is step back and ask questions like, what do you mean by rational? What do you mean by faith? What do we mean by evidence? Because there is no generic sense of rationality unless you've bought into what I spoke about in terms of Enlightenment, post-Enlightenment ways of thinking. And so when we look at it in these terms, when we ask these types of questions, then we can help that person to open up within their assumptions. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of things that they have accepted that are ideologically dominant within society or culture. So they've accepted a particular conception of rationality, and based on that have come to see faith as irrational. Mm-hmm. So it really helps that person to reconsider some of the ways in which they've been thinking about reason or rationality.
So as an example for our audience, what would be some of the examples or objections that they would raise? And how should we actually encounter it?
Right. So one of the objections would be, well, science, you know, goes against faith. Hmm. And that person obviously believes that rationality is generic and science is the best embodiment of what that rationality is. And one of the ways in which you counter that is by showing that science itself is more of a culture than a discipline, that science has a narrative, and that particular ways of thinking, a particular sociological ways of understanding a particular conception of rationality. And there are built-in limitations. So there is no generic overarching rationality that transcends history. Rationality is something that emerges out of the stream of history. And so you adhere to one or another conception of rationality. And so really digging out through these questions. And that also goes back to what John talks about in terms of the narrative mm-hmm. of that particular person, or that life story of that person. And really getting to know where within that life story that tensions arose and why they gave up one version of reason or faith and kind of, you know, walked away from it and decided to go along with an alternate narrative mm. or an alternate paradigm or perspective. So asking these types of questions gets to the heart of the issue. Because if we just deal at it at a peripheral or surface level and just talk about reasons or rationality or reduce rationality to reasons and do apologetics in terms of just accumulative case arguments, we really perpetrate or perpetuate, you know, the positions that they affirm.
But would you say that there is some use to making those cumulative cases?
Oh, yes.
In terms of bringing someone to that very path of seeking truth.
Yes. I mean, there is a place for reasons, but there is also a place for understanding how those reasons fit into particular frames of rationality.
Yeah.
Because how we provide the weight for these particular reasons and arrange them within our cognitive structure to come up with the basic worldviews or paradigms that we endorse is as important as the specific reasons themselves.
Yeah, an example that I'm thinking of as you say that is that when we talk about reason sort of being almost dependent on the tradition or the paradigm that you're a part of, sometimes we think as long as we can just give people enough facts that they will say, oh, okay, I either acknowledge that what you're telling me is true, but I don't want to believe it, or they will be forced to convert. And that's simply not the case often, because I think that we can all, if we think hard enough, come up with examples where we would not. Let me give you the specific example I'm thinking of. A number of years ago in India, there was the Ganesh milk miracle. Do you remember the Ganesh milk miracle?
Yes.
Where Ganesh, the Hindu deity who has the body of a man and the head of an elephant. And across the country, whether it was statues or icons, if you would hold milk up to it, the milk would disappear. And it would disappear into the statue and into the... You can go on YouTube and look these things up.
Yeah.
Now, if you were a Hindu, this for you would be confirmation that Ganesh is real. If you're a conservative evangelical Christian who believes in the spiritual world, you look at that and say, demonic, right? And so you always are interpreting through your tradition and through your lens and what's reasonable to hold. There's no uninterpreted facts.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing I want to mention along with that. If I place a cup of water in front of you and it's half full, you can either look at it as half full or half empty. But the evidence, quote-unquote evidence in front of you, the cup and the water, will not tell you what to decide. So if you're an optimist, you always see the cup as half full. If you're a pessimist, you always see the cup as half empty. So you bring the paradigm or the worldview to interpret the facts and to provide the kinds of meanings and the weight that is needed in order to make sense of it. So there is a level of pre-commitment that goes beyond facts, mm-hmm. what we call first principles or first philosophy. And so unless we get to some of those questions, we won't be able to unearth what some of those tensions were that brought someone through the process of deconversion.
Yeah, so if I may ask Prashant and also Michael here, Jaden, also please jump in if you have an example. In your experience of seeing conversions happen, because Michael, your research work is on that very topic of seeing people, the various factors that lead them to Christian faith, how would you see this explanation in terms of being applicable there?
Well, in my case, the Chinese atheist that I was working with, I had a guy who said he had never even heard the word Bible when he was in China, and they're indoctrinated with naturalist thinking. And in terms of the factors that led them to be more open to Christianity, they actually listed some cumulative arguments of they had never heard this, they had never read the Bible, they had never been in an atmosphere, and I think, John, you talk about this, where you had academic freedom and intellectual freedom to actually explore different worldviews. When they came into my course the first time, I told them, the point of the course is not to beat you over the head that you become a Christian. It's that you are able to articulate your own perspective and understand other perspectives. And when they realized that it's not an indoctrination class, they had the freedom to express themselves. And in the process, the arguments for God's existence seemed very credible to them. And, I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of cases where people have mentioned that those who have deconverted have specifically pointed out that they've been, like in some of their Bible studies or apologetics events, they've been encouraged to basically doubt their faith as well in order to understand it better. And that has even led them to actually make a decision against their faith. There've been cases like that too. What do you think about that in terms of, as Christians, should we be intentional in terms of doubting or questioning? And how do you understand that?
Well, can I give an example of just a... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, Prashant.
Yes.
Oh, no, sorry about that. That's all right.
Go ahead, Prashant.
Okay. So that is actually a very relevant question to me. So, for example, you know, I was born and raised in a Christian family, and I lived in a pretty tight Christian bubble, and which included church and school and home, and I did not have any questions or doubts about my faith or anything like that. But that was precisely because I lived in that kind of echo chamber at a very young age. And so when I moved away from my family, out of that bubble, into an environment where I was talking and having discussions with Hindus and Muslims, there were a lot of questions that came my way. And I remember we would get off work and we'd go to a coffee shop and we would be the last ones out of that coffee shop, practically help the guy pull the shutters down and close, because mm-hmm. we would just be sitting there for hours and talking about the deeper things of life and philosophical issues and things like that. And a lot of these guys were very good friends of mine who I still keep in touch with. And they would ask me some incredibly difficult questions about the Christian faith. And I remember always giving them very Christianese, very hyper-spiritual responses to all of these questions. And deep down inside, I myself knew that I was not convinced with my own responses. And I remember all of that came to head one particular night after a conversation with a friend of mine called Vishnu, a Hindu guy, really sharp thinker. And he really pushed me on some issues of Christian atonement. And I just felt deflated because I didn't know how to give a response. And when I went home, I remember getting on my knees and praying about this. And, you know, I realized, first of all, that I was so preoccupied with trying to defend what I believed in that I didn't even pay attention to the fact that, you know, do I even know why I believe what I believe? And so that actually is what took me down a path to really understand what it is I believe and what are the things that I held as a child, what were the things that were taught to me by my parents, by my church, and where do I situate all of these things? Now, the exact same thing happened to another childhood friend of mine, and I know that he went the other way. For him, these questions did not push him in the direction of investigation. Rather, it pushed him away from the faith of his childhood. And so I found it interesting. I was listening to one of John's talks, and he talked about he made a point about there's a baseline set of personality or characteristics that a person may have that could make them prone to deconversion, which I thought was a very, very insightful observation. I'd never thought of that before. I was assuming that all of this is entirely based on, you know, rationality and how we process information. But the fact of the matter is, Jacob, is that, you know, kind of going back to that question about, well, how do we know if they're really saved? I agree with John that, you know, when I was reading through some of this material, I was thinking of the systematic theology part of it as well. And I was thinking, well, what do we do with all of that? But the point of the matter is that a lot of these experiences that these deep converts have experienced have been experienced even by people who have not deconverted. Mm-hmm. So for me, for example, I have had experiences with fellow Christians and church leadership where I was hurt and I was disappointed. And, you know, that did not make me question my salvation or anything like that. Yeah. So I'm not entirely sure if the question of whether, you know, were they really saved in the first place is necessarily a valid question, as much as what do we do about these factors that contribute to deconverts and people who have not deconverted to experiencing the kind of pain that goes with this.
And I think, Prashant, we need to actually also deal with the confusion that we have between belief and doubt. we kind of like see them as opposite. I think the opposite of belief is unbelief, not doubt. And I would like to actually read something that like James K. Smith, he wrote in How Not to Be Secular. He says that even as faith endures in our age, believing doesn't come easy. Faith is fraught. Confession is haunted by an inescapable sense of its contestability. We don't believe instead of doubting. We believe while doubting. We are all Thomas now. So let me just touch on that personality aspect, John, and that Prashant brought it up. Can you talk more about that? I mean, can personality trait lead someone to a particular position?
Yeah, it certainly seems like it can. And when we talk about personality traits, we're talking about psychological traits that people primarily are born with, and then values that they deeply hold. And research tends to show that people who are maybe a little bit higher in intelligence, more critical and analytical in their thinking, those who are open to experience, who say they are interested in learning about new things, trying new things, meeting new people, having new experiences, those who have a low tolerance for authoritarian leadership, a high tolerance for ambiguity, place a high value on self-determination and needing to be in control of their own destiny. Also, those who have a low value on benevolence and expressing, you know, kind of an unconditional love or kindness, and at least having 1 year of university education, tend to be people who statistically, are more likely or are in more danger of losing their faith.
Okay. How would we interpret that in terms of those traits may not necessarily be seen negative?
Correct.
Right? Those are positive traits as well. So how do we redeem that in terms of not letting that lead someone to a decision that would, you know, derail them from their faith, but continue or instill faith robustly in them?
Yeah. So in the book, I title it A Recipe for Disaster for a reason, and that's because recipes have three elements. They have ingredients, and they have a preparation of those ingredients, and then an environment where they're cooked. And the parallels when it comes to deconversion are that there are ingredients, and we've just mentioned those, the characteristics or temperament or personality traits and values that people bring with them. Mm-hmm. And then there is the preparation of those ingredients. There's nothing wrong with any of those character traits that we just mentioned. And but the problem is if those are prepared improperly, then in the same way if you prepare certain ingredients in your baking improperly, then you're not going to get the outcome that you desire. Mm-hmm. And typically in the church, there are at least four things that methods of preparation that set people up for a crisis of faith. One of those would be when we take people who are highly intellectual, who are analytical in their thinking, have a low tolerance for authoritarian kind of leadership, and we say to them, this is Christianity. It's this massive, bloated raft of beliefs that you have to take. It's an all or nothing kind of a thing. Prashant was talking about this earlier. And then they say, but wait a minute, I don't think I do accept this, or this is not in line with my values. And so therefore, I guess if it's an all or nothing ultimatum you're giving me, I have to believe in, and by the way, this is not a personal comment I'm making here. I'm just parroting off what I often hear. If I have to believe in inerrancy, if I have to believe in literal six-day creation, if I have to believe that God annihilated the Canaanites, if I have to believe all of these things, then I can't be a Christian because I don't see those things as justifiable. Mm. So I guess I'm not a Christian anymore, right? So
John,
Jump in.
For you. Yeah, my question was, you know, kind of piggybacking on one thing that Jacob mentioned. He said, well, what's wrong with these things? I mean, these things are intrinsically good traits anyways. And to that, I want to ask you, I mean, it seems to me like the age demographic of it seems rather obvious, but do you think, like, to what extent are cultural aspects playing into this? Because when I look at a lot of those traits like, open to new things and this kind of allusion to rationality and things like that, a lot of those seem to me to have a lot of Western ethos to it. So when you look at like all the three Indians, there's three Indians on this panel, I'm sure the other two guys will know what I'm talking about. In Indian culture, we're not encouraged to to trailblaze our own path. We are encouraged to conform to the rest of the crowd. So standing alone or standing by yourself and blazing a new path is not necessarily seen as a virtue. It's seen as you bucking the system. In the same sense, we are not encouraged to push back or rebel against any sort of authority structure and things like that. So would you say in that context that is it accurate to say that is deconversion primarily a Western problem, or is there aspects of it that apply to Eastern culture as well? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I think that that's a challenging question, and one that I'm not quite sure that I would be able to say much intelligently about, because all I've ever studied and looked at is people in the West. I would say certainly, though you are identifying some things that are characteristic of Western culture, it would be interesting to look at what are some of the characteristics of people who tend to leave their faith from outside of the West.
Let me just jump in here. We are short of time. We just have 4 more minutes left. So I just want to give at the end everyone at least 30 seconds to give your final remarks. But before I do that, is it possible, John, for you to talk about the 4 degrees of preparation that you talk about that with churches might set up someone to actually the crisis of faith and how to prevent that?
Sure.
Maybe just in a minute.
Yeah, sure. And really briefly, over-preparation occurs, like I said, when we force a version or a take or a spin on Christianity that we have misunderstood for the essentials of Christianity on someone and say, this is what it is to be a Christian and you need to do this or otherwise you can't be one. You need to buy into it lock, stock, and barrel. And when we do that, we set up people for a crisis because we have mistaken our understanding and our version of Christianity for Christianity itself. And I think a remedy for that is to focus on the essentials, which are identified, I think, in the early Christian creeds, focus on what it means to be to be born again. And so that would avoid the problem with that one. I think another problem that we have is that we underprepare people. That's been mentioned already this evening. And underpreparation occurs when we don't help folks think well about their faith. That comes from an ancient book how we live that and think that out in a modern culture. And then lastly, let me just say that I think we sometimes ill-prepare people by not giving them really healthy, well-balanced biblical concepts. And then we implant in them expectations that aren't met. And when those aren't met, they get very disappointed and say the whole thing is a sham.
I take that as your final remark, John. Michael.
Okay, I have my own recipe. If you want to be a pastor and have a bunch of deconverts, I think number one, you want to teach a no-risk Christianity, where it's predictable and safe, and because if they're going to follow you as they follow Christ, they're going to learn that the Word of God doesn't match up with the Christian experience that they're seeing in the church. Secondly, just if you want to have deconverts, assure everyone they're saved, even when they're not, and don't teach Matthew 7, where Jesus again and again warns about false teachers, false converts. And also, if you want to have deconverts, create an atmosphere that is sterile from questions, doubts, and struggles.
Finney?
Yeah, we've been talking about a lot of things, and we, I think, agree that deconversion is primarily an internal issue. So I want to make it very personal and something that is applicable to all of us, especially as listeners. What are we doing? What are you and I doing in terms of how we speak, what we say, and how we live our lives in order to provide the path, knowingly or unknowingly, to someone to become a deconvert?
Prashant, in 5 seconds. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Well, I think we have to be careful not to split up 1 Peter 3:15 into 2 parts, because if we affirm only the gentleness and respect part and ignore the truth, then we become relativistic and liberal. But if we ignore the gentleness and respect part, we ourselves can come across as judgmental, legalistic, or self-righteous. And so I think we need to begin with the first sentence in that passage, which is, first sanctify Christ in your hearts.
Excellent. And for our audience, I just want to say that please go and buy John's book, A Recipe for Disaster. Go check out his website, foundandlost.com.
Dot org. Found and lost. No, I'm sorry. It's johnmarriott.org or losingmyfaith.org.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time and efforts in listening to our radio show. Thank you for all the contribution for my guests, wonderful guests here in the studio, and also Prashant from Iowa. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you, Jacob.